everybody, and welcome to Stage Voices. I'm your host, Matt, and today we have a very, very fantastic show with our great guest, a great, great friend of mine, very talented individual, Matt Thompson. Now, before we get into that, a little housekeeping. Just want to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the great people, amazing people at amodernprofession.com. That's right. It's part of the Modern Profession Network, and you can go check out this podcast plus many others at amodernprofession.com. So this guy, Matt Thompson, is a pinnacle of San Diego theater. There we go. Get my mouth working there. He is a playwright. He is an actor. He is a improviseur, and just a genius at comedy. He's also taught a lot. He's a teacher for, I want to say several colleges. I know he's taught at several. So if you are somebody in the San Diego area who has their eye set on achieving dreams in the theater, there's a good chance you probably have worked with Matt Thompson as a student or as a colleague. So I'm very excited to have him on this podcast. And we go into some pretty fun stuff. Go into some pretty, pretty fun stuff. Especially playwriting, which is his, I feel, is where his expertise lies. So, without further ado, Matt Thompson on Stage Voices. Yeah. All right, already the show goes on night. Till the morning we dream so long. Anybody ever wonder when they would see the thunder? Just remember when you come to the show. What's up? Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Stage Voices. Right now, I am here with a really great friend of mine that I've known for not as long as some, but over 10 years, I would say
it's
now.
It's been over 10 years, yeah.
Yeah, because we met during Deep, Deep Trouble.
Oh, there was some trouble there.
Which, yes, there was. Yes, that was in 2005.
I think it was four, even earlier than that, I think. Was
that? Oh, no. Well, it opened in 2005, so I think it might have. Yeah,
four or five, something like that.
Yeah, so, ha, ha, ha. But, yeah, and you've done a lot of things. Oh, I should announce your name. This is Matt Thompson.
Hello.
Yes. So you've done a lot of things. You've been a great actor and I'd say improvisationalist, director, theater owner. One of the most things, though, that I think that of when I think of you is a playwright.
Yes.
Yes. You're a very impressive playwright.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. I think one of the things that just kind of goes to show how kind of great you are is you've been able to just write these plays and submit them into places to get them published, and then they just get published.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've understood how to use it. Well, the accessible plays are the ones that get published, and the less accessible ones are more difficult to get published. But yes, it's very kind of you.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long have you been writing plays for?
I've been writing plays since I was exactly 19 years old. I was attending MiraCosta College.
Oh, wow.
Back in 1990. And I'm 92 years old. And I was taking a literature class called, I don't remember what the literature class was, but I read a story called The Whore of Mensa by Woody Allen. It's a short story. And I was inspired by that. And I said, you know, this has got to be put on the stage somewhere. So I looked and there wasn't an adaptation of it. So I made an adaptation of it. That was the first thing I wrote was...
oh, wow.
Was that?
An adaptation of a book, of a short story.
Of a short story, yeah. And that's I directed great. It because I couldn't find anyone to direct it. Like, I don't want to direct this. I don't know what it is. So then I directed it. But that was the first thing I ever, quote, wrote. I mean, it was mostly an adaptation.
Nice.
Yeah.
So were you involved in theater anyway before that?
Just in high school a couple of years, but, you know, going to the theater was like what my parents thought was going to the AMC. It wasn't, never did any arts other than just going into theater. But when was I, 17 and a junior, and I chased a pretty girl into the theater because I thought she was pretty, and then I asked her out. The girl said no, and then I stayed in the theater.
That's how it usually happens.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Wow. So, you actually just didn't really have a whole lot of like theater background in like your young
past. When I was young, yeah, when I was a kid, I had no like I don't think CYT and stuff, which is so great for young people. I think it's amazing, and we didn't have anything like that because I was moving around all the time. So, and that was not my CYT experience. Was taking my brother and I and dressing up in, you know, paper bags for Thanksgiving and forcing him to be a, you know, a Native Indian, and you know, that was it. So I didn't have any like young people training in theater at all.
You were like very imaginative.
I was very imaginative. I still am. I want to send a cow to the moon. Call it a cowstronaut. You know, I it was when I was young. I was very. Yes. People thought you were kind of crazy. As you know, sometimes in theater, it's like very strange. I am still strange, which.
Well, that's great. That's the best kind of thing.
Of course.
You have a rubber chicken.
I do have this rubber chicken. It lays an egg.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm not really fond of it. I also have a crystal skull. Which, as we know, is from the best of the Indiana Jones movies.
Yes,
there. Yes,
right there.
Got to get out of the library.
So,
because the best thing about watching Crystal Skull is that you can say when you watch Temple of Doom, you're not watching the worst Indiana Jones movie anymore.
That is great. Yeah, that's a great thing. And I mean, soon we're going to have a fifth one.
Yes, a fifth one, which is such a great idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe we'll just say, hey. Crystal Skull is not the worst.
You're right. Crystal Skull might not be the worst. Anyway, sorry.
Back into theater. One of the things that I think was really cool about, you know, childhood and all that is just being imaginative. And I don't know if it's just my own like cadre self, my cadre 34-year-old self, but I actually spent some time, you know, teaching youth theater. And one of my more recent classes I taught was comedy. And I thought I was doing these kids a great service by teaching them how to you know, do Monty Python.
How did they take to that?
They asked me after they read through the scripts, they're like, so how is this funny? And then I was like, I don't know if this is for me. I don't know.
Well, don't you know? I mean, you're a theater individual, especially when you teach and things. And you see patterns because I'm very old now.
Yeah.
You're behind me many years. But... you see, especially with comedy, how it changes, how one generation may think something's funny and then the next generation.
Yeah.
It changes.
It does.
Yeah, Monty Python does, even though it's 30, 40 years ago, still is funny. Maybe to some people, they don't think it's funny.
I mean, it is like a completely different, even like, you know, region of comedy. If you look at, you know, British versus, you know, American, you know.
There's British, American, and then there's Deep, Deep Trouble, which is totally different than all of those. So.
Yeah. Well, also, actually, you know, you bring that up. One thing that kind of made me take notice of you is that that's a very weird phrase that I just said.
Yes, you noticed me.
Yes.
I took notice. Matt Warburton took notice of me.
In the midst of everything that you were doing when we met at Deep, Deep Trouble, I was doing sound, you're performing. And actually, this was something, you were in LA at the time. They decided to do auditions.
In
Los Angeles. Yeah. And so you're up in LA at the time. And so you're like, oh, I'll come back down.
I did because I like San Diego and I like the theater environment in Los Angeles. The theater atmosphere is not as conducive to being able to, for me, to be able to work as much. So I didn't have a hard time coming back to San Diego.
Yeah.
So, and that's where Lance also came down. The two of us were.
Yeah.
Lance Smith. I mean,
which he became another big San Diego heavy.
He's a big San Diego heavy down here too. Yeah. So.
Yes, maybe one day we'll be on this podcast.
Perhaps. Oh.
But yeah, I always thought that was really great. But you also had a lot of, you know, because you went to LA, you had a lot of these like really, really great credits.
Yes, Baywatch, very exceptional credit.
So did you go from San Diego then to LA and then started doing some shows up there? And then like is SeaWorld, is that what kind of like blasted you off up into the LA realm?
Yeah, my girlfriend at the time, Kira Sultanovich, who's a stand-up comic now. She works a lot up there. She wanted to move. I didn't want to move from San Diego in 97. And then she moved up there and she said, I'm going with or without you. So I left and went with her. And the ironic thing is all the years that I worked in Los Angeles in terms of great, you know, television stuff, I did like an episode of CSI, but everything else I actually did TV down here.
Yeah.
So everything else is down here. So did you do any of those Stu Siegel shows? Those are the shows that were down here that he packed up and left.
I did one. I did a it was like a show called like Splitsville or something.
Splitsville.
Yes. Oh. And I actually got to be a waiter in that show.
Oh.
Yes, I was background, but I got my own wardrobe.
Oh.
So I mean, I was like that level of standing in the background.
Oh.
And nothing ever came of it. So, yeah.
That's fine.
Yes.
Now you're here. This is where it came to.
Although, you know, part of me too was like, I saw all these people walking around and like, you know, these are the big guys, you know, that you can't look directly at, which...
Stop looking at me, man.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, it was this whole like situation of these guys that were like, you know, these are, you know, they're better than you. And then I was like, these are nobodies.
Yeah, there really are nobodies.
And the show didn't even take off, so...
Yeah.
Where are you now?
Right. Well, you don't have anything. As a foundation of theater, you know that in film and TV, most really good film and TV actors come from the theater. And it's they do. They're very talented people. And I don't know if it's insecurities or what. And, you know, that some TV actors just feel they're better than others. And some don't. Some are really great. But, you know, but I don't know. You do all the things. Didn't you just write a play for your master's thesis? Adapted.
I adapted Comedy of Errors.
Comedy of Errors,
and then directed that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was fun. Actually, I really got into writing plays. You kind of charged my horse for that. I started writing like some short films before going to the SDSU theater program. I was going to be a film director. Like that was my course.
So when you were in the SSU, in the MA program, did you take the playwriting course? There's only one.
I did.
Yeah. Who was teaching that? That was...
That was Aurori. Mm. Aurori Koo. Yes.
I don't know that individual.
I mean, she was great. And they set up the whole thing, the 48-hour play festival.
Oh, right.
And here's an interesting bit about that has to do with you. So I learned that I do much better as a playwright when I'm maybe like under pressure, when I have, you know, limited time and I just can't sit and think about it.
Yeah.
So I was writing this play and I think like I sat down and I wrote it in 10 hours. And there's like language that I used that I wasn't like, how can I write this play like Matt Thompson? But I kind of like tapped in. I let that like inner fool out, and I'm like, I'm gonna play with words a little bit. And so there was this part where this person was like, oh yeah, I want you to act like I could have said like, you know, maybe like anything. It was potato bug, because I thought that was really funny.
It is funny, potato bug.
Yes.
I mean, just a potato bug is just funny in itself. I mean.
Yeah.
So you're using language and mixing it up.
Yeah, and I'm like, this is a funny sounding word.
Yeah.
And I like, you've always done a lot of that, especially the first show that like of yours that we actually worked on together, Hemingway's Rose.
Oh yes, the Hemingway's Rose. Was that the one with the where the shirt smelled like bacon and stuff like that?
It might have been. It
could have been. It was very random.
Yes.
There was a lot of random. There was a lot of, but it all meant something. There was all something that tied it in terms of the language, and I think that's what sometimes people do read that, like, it's all random, it doesn't mean anything. Well, it does mean something. You just have to dig underneath there, like Peter Brook says about rough theater. You got to get behind all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
See it. Not that I'm anywhere near Peter Brook.
But no, I mean, I think that there is something there. And like, especially the way that you write, it's very different. There's a lot of like the silly stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like Hemingway's Rose, where it was all... very, very goofy, but it all meant something.
Sam Shepard was he was the reason I started writing plays. I started reading him when
I was
a teenager. I was like, oh my gosh, you can do this. All of his early one acts when he was doing it at La Mama in New York and all those things were, he just inspired me that language doesn't have to be a barrier. It can be used as a tool to telling a story instead of having something immediately being told to you. You know, you can guise things behind language, but also have emotions and feelings and themes behind them. As opposed to just saying, I feel this way, I love you, I hate you, and that kind of thing. It's always hidden behind something else. Or buried, such as Sam Shepard's Buried Child.
So it's not that I was watching The Phantom Menace.
Oh, why? Why were you doing that?
We're getting ready for Force Awakens.
All right, okay.
And I just remember, like, just watching it, and there's the scene with young Anakin saying goodbye to his mother. I'm supposed to be like, that's like a heavy, that should be a heavy scene, you know, this little kid possibly never going to see his mom again because who he's so attached to.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's going to join
Jedi
Jedi school. Who knows? He might not, you know, ever come back. And like the dialogue was like literally like, well, will I ever see you again? I hope so. Like, it was just so like chunky and stilted, and
that's called George Lucas.
Yes,
that was his writing. Which, it was pretty bad, huh?
Yeah, it was really bad.
Yeah, it's kind of probably one of the worst. It is the worst Star Wars film ever made.
Yeah. So.
So it could have been a lot more.
I mean, but yeah, that's I think a great example of just language being a barrier, but. You seem to kind of go over the top and then say and make things, you know, poetic.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I try. I mean, I do. A lot of my other work is it's different. I veered in a different way. It's weird when you get older as a writer, you start writing different ways. After I took this, the second MFA program that I have, this second master's, and it was playwriting, and there was much more emphasis on that than there was in the first master's. And
yeah,
it did. It challenged me to bend the way that you use language in terms of storytelling, and sometimes it can be open and honest and direct, but then sometimes it's more fun if it's not.
Yeah.
You know? So we'll see. This one you're working on hopefully is very straightforward.
Oh, yes. Well, forgive me if I'm forgetting the name of the one that we did for the Fringe Festival. I want to say the Triangle Tragedy.
It was, yeah. And then I renamed it the 146 Point Flame.
Yes.
Yeah, about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire of 1911.
Yeah, so that was an example of something that I worked on with you, that the language still had that almost that kind of like foolishness, or that like the like randomness that it's from Hemingway's Rose or like some of these other shows, but it was so heavy that it kind of, and it wasn't trying to be funny.
No, of course not, because it's a very tragic event. So it was hopefully somewhat poetic in terms of its expression.
Oh, it was very poetic, and that's what I really dug. I'm like, it's very like Matt Thompson-y. I always say that. Like, it's very Matt Thompson-y, where like language is very poetic, and it can kind of jump from like one word to another that you wouldn't think that would be, that they'd be linked in some ways, but they are, and it, like, it pushes to get this idea across, which I really, really enjoy.
Well, thank you. That's normally how my brain works. That's why I bring up Cowstronauts.
Yes. Yeah, and you do have this way of improvising or just coming up with things that is very unlike anything that I've ever seen or heard of. When people normally go to do, you know, improv or whatever, you know, the whole idea... A friend of mine who, you know, took classes at the Groundlings is like, yeah, I mean, when you're doing improv, you're not supposed to try, and it's just...
Yeah, you're not supposed to try to be funny. And I went through Improv Olympia. When I started at Groundlings, and then I ran out of money. And then I went through Second City, which is more sketch comedy than improv. And it's weird, because I consider myself physically like silent comic, when we did with mime work and everything for all those years. I'm fairly good at that, but I'm not bad with like off-the-cuff stuff. But and sketch comedy, I'm okay. But then when it gets into pure, like, structured improv, I'm kind of scarily bad. I don't know how to do it. I'm like, because
really?
Yeah, the boundaries. Because, like, my brain goes so random that people are like, what are you talking about? Like, we walked inside.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I saw a giant marshmallow man filled with pockets of orangutan lips. Okay, well, we're not sure what to do. They don't know what to do with it, because my brain doesn't stay attached
to that. You're the wild card.
I am the wild card, which is not good in an improv situation. But I love teaching improv. That's what it is. I do that, too, so college level. So, which is so fun, because then you see everybody else shining and having a good time while I'm sitting at the bar.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I learned that, too, because I'm really great at teaching. I have some certain games that I love playing. But as far as, you know, doing improv... If I've been doing it for a long time or for a while, then I feel like I'm a little bit more like there, a little bit more primed. But if I haven't been, I have no idea. And I'll go out for the orangutan lips.
Yeah, you know? With the orangutan lips and stuff like that. Well, you've been working at the American Comedy Company down there, so yeah. I'm sure you've picked up on a different kind of improvisation in terms of, even though they're stand-up comics and they have their sets.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have to improvise a little bit. And we saw you in New York. You handled a raucous, crazy crowd with the baby.
The baby doorman.
We saw you. You were there in New York doing stand-up.
Yes, I was. I was doing the stand-up in New York.
Yes, sir. You did a very good job.
At Lucky's.
At Lucky's, that's right. You were doing great.
Yeah.
Anya got up and left and was insulted by the comic before you.
Yes.
And then I almost got in a fight with a Yankee fan upstairs over some drinks. So it was a good day.
It was a very good day.
It was a good day in New York.
Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, it's another great topic of. So we worked on the New York Fringe Festival together.
We did, yes.
Yes.
Then the San Diego and the New York.
Yes.
That's right.
Both Fringe Festivals, fringing it up. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to go into the New York Fringe Festival?
I don't know. I wanted a higher profile for telling the story. And
yeah.
We got, 10 people. So that was higher than the audience we had before. So
yeah.
As you remember, our audiences were kind of small, but we had good reviews. But I just wanted to tell the story in a different place other than San Diego. And so I thought that was the appropriate place to do it.
It was good. Yeah, it really amazed me about the New York crowds. How
they got into it, though. The play was called Who's Afraid of Me, Myself, and Edward Albee?
Yes.
Which is a very unique kind of play. And I had those discussions with Edward Albee about it.
It was your love letter to Edward Albee, wasn't it?
It was. It was a love letter to Edward Albee. And he's like, well, I guess I got to see it now. So he didn't come to see it, but he kept writing back and forth, which was nice.
That is great. Yeah.
So... it's got some legs, I think. It's hard because it's a two-hander and it's 80 minutes, but it goes in loops. And like Susan Laurie Parks, Susan Laurie Parks. So she writes in loops and talks about circular ideas and how you tell these stories. So a lot of that happens in there, which leaves a lot of people going, huh? But then if you dig deeper, like I talk about with Rough Theater with Peter Brook, it's like you got to dig in there. You really got to get in there. There's not a lot of meat there, but the language and the characters. I think New York, of all places, most of the people really appreciated it in terms of what we had to do and how quick it was, and rehearsing in my house and in a subway and
yes,
it was fun though. It was a grand experience.
Oh yeah, it was really really good. And just the way that there are so many theaters in there that they opened up like a school, so we could do theaters or maybe it used to be a school and then they just put seats in there, but
something like that.
But there are so many spaces in New York to do theater.
Well, it's the center of all theater for the United States, so I thought we should be there.
It was great, it was fun.
We had a good time.
Fantastic experience. Reenacting the opening to Ghostbusters and the
yes, we New did. York did Public the four Lab. Of us did. Yeah, me, you, and Jared and Jeff.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Now, who was the fourth Ghostbuster there, though? Who was the Winston? I don't remember.
I don't know.
We don't know.
Well,
we'll say it was Jeff because he wasn't here.
Well,
or Jared.
Winston wouldn't have been in that scene anyway because
he wouldn't. But we kind of CGI'd him in there. So yeah. He was in there before.
Oh, okay.
But sorry.
Yes.
We're all a little Winston and
all
a little not.
Yes. So, going back a little bit, you worked on a play that was a farce with a couple other people. Was that the one of the first ones that you? What's the name?
If the Shoe Fits.
If the Shoe Fits, that we did at.
Did that at Coronado Playhouse? Coronado, like a long time ago with Brian Mackey and Aaron Adams and. Yeah, that was a fun piece, and you're doing the sound. We had Peter Larlam; he did the voiceover.
Yes, yes. So. Was that one of the first farces that you've done, or did you?
That was the first farce I ever had published. It was a co-written piece, but it was published back in 2005. It was the very first play that I had published, even though it was co-written.
Yeah.
But
so what was that process like of co-writing a play with two other people?
That's really difficult because what happened was this guy named Matt, another Matt, when I was working on cruise ships, we were doing this entertainment. So he came and wrote this 12-minute little farce piece with three of the four characters in If the Shoe Fits and said, what do you think of this? I'm like, well, this is funny. So we did this on the ships for a couple of years, and I got back on land and then moved back to San Diego where I had more time to write. And so I was writing more. And I thought, this would make a great full-length farce. And then I expanded the whole thing. And then another friend of mine added a few pages here and there. And then I added a character, and it was difficult, but at the same time simple, because he had written one section of it. Then I just took the whole thing and did it myself, and then kind of reviewed it with a friend. But I have co-written pieces, which can be challenging, but also very fun at the same time if you have the right writing partner.
Yeah, it seems like it would almost kind of hinder some of your creativity in some ways. In other ways, it probably could help you, because you're bouncing off of people that you don't normally work with, or ideas you wouldn't normally work with.
But it's very true, because Harry Truman had a very famous quote that said, "It's amazing what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit," which I always think is such a cool quote, especially coming from government. But in terms of egos and theater and entertainment, people always seem to want credit.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. It depends. Each project that I do, because I've co-written probably 7 or 8, 9, maybe 10 pieces, and they're always with different people for different projects. Like, I could write a dramatic piece about a historical piece, co-writing it with somebody. Be great. Mistletoe Music and Mayhem was a musical comedy holiday show that I wrote with Raimi.
Yeah,
And Phil Johnson. But that was a musical. You know, Phil's got all this comedy background, and then Phil has all this comedy background. Raimi had all the music background.
Yeah.
And I kind of put all those things together and contribute on both ends. And it is. It's unique. It just has to, you have to find the right team, I guess, is what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
In TV and film, you know, it's like you got a bunch of, especially in TV, you got a bunch of people sitting around the room, and they're all throwing ideas. And, you know, but theater is very exclusive because it doesn't change. So when you put something down, it changes over the course of time, but it's yours. It's the authors. It's the playwrights.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the things that is so different from film, because I mean, when you think of who wrote, you know, movies, you know, Jurassic Park, you know that Steven Spielberg directed it.
Yeah,
but I'll struggle to
remember who wrote it.
Yeah,
you know, Michael Crichton did the book, but then you know, who adapted this from the? It is it's such a weird thing, I would imagine, and I know a lot of writers. Alan McDonald was a television writer for CSI all those years. And
I do know that from reading, doing research on the internet, though, is David Koepp, who wrote Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull.
He did. Didn't he write? He wrote another indie film, didn't he? Or
I don't know.
He wrote something else. Yeah. I don't know.
But that was, I just learned that like the other day, and Jurassic Park. I've been knowing about Jurassic Park since it came out.
But do you know who wrote the screenplay for it?
David Koepp wasn't that the writer?
Oh, I thought you said for Indiana Jones and Crystal Skull.
Oh, yeah.
He did, but he also wrote Jurassic Park.
He also wrote Jurassic Park, and he did Crystal Skull, and he's also doing the next one.
Oh, the fifth. I know he's doing the fifth one. That's right. Well, Jurassic Park, I'd buy him a drink.
Exactly.
I'd give him a minivan full of women. I'd give him whatever he wants for Jurassic Park.
Yes, but. You know, for something like a play, I mean, the writer is king.
Yeah.
I almost kind of feel like who directed, you know, well, it depends who directed.
Yeah, but it's weird because the play, well, it's a visual medium. You know?
It is.
The film
it
is a visual medium, whereas you have theater, which is more of a, you know, it's a synergy there. So that who's creating that synergy, the director has to help it along, but it's the playwright that is the seed of all that creation. You would think that would be the same thing.
Yeah.
Screenplays and films, but it's not, because you go on a set and everything changes. Oh, we're gonna cut this, take this out, we're gonna move that, I'm gonna do some. The writer's nowhere to be found. The writer's just basically a foundation and gets paid a lot of money to just give you and then walk away for the most part, or rewrite stuff. But because I'm very successful as a screenwriter, man. Yes. I know all these things.
You did write for Frasier, or did you submitted for Frasier?
I did. I wrote a spec script for Frasier. I wrote a spec script for Star Trek Voyager.
Got
passed over. Lid looked it over and said, "This is great. Goodbye." That was it. But and then I wrote a couple pilots of sitcoms, and then I continued to drink.
Yes,
because that seemed to be more lucrative.
Nice.
Yeah, but
which I really enjoyed your the Frasier script that I actually.
Do you remember
used.
This Frasier script? I don't. I don't even remember the Frasier.
The one where with the games.
Oh, with the games.
Yes.
And the mailbox and all that.
The mailbox, yes.
So here's a bit of, do you know what I did with that piece?
What did you do with that piece?
It's sitting on my shelf now. It's called, I took the best 10 minutes of that Frasier script, and I made it a 10-minute short play, and it's published.
Nice.
And it's called Don't Play Games With Me.
Yes, yes, okay.
So I just kind of changed the names, changed some situations when, you know, Frasier wouldn't give me, you know, $100,000 for the script. And then I said, I might as well make $60 on it.
Yes. Well, that's great, though. I mean, it has a life in theater.
It's repurposing.
Yeah, it's repurposing. Material,
hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So is it kind of, must be interesting, though, like kind of taking that idea of, especially you create so much, to then go to characters that are already created.
I don't know. You know, this is the weird thing, and I probably get wrapped in the mouth about this, but I know a couple of TV writers. One of them worked at SeaWorld for a long time, Alan McDonald, good friend of mine, and he's doing very, very well in Los Angeles. And like, if you're going to write a sitcom for 22 minutes, it seems a whole heck of a lot easier to write for characters that are already created. And you know what, that's what the Frasier script was. You already knew the characters. You knew how they would act, you know, as you get going after season two, season three.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, this is pretty easy. He'd be put into these situations. Here's a couple characters here and you're done. I mean, it's not that difficult compared to, in my opinion, is to writing something like a novel or a play where you're starting, where you have to create all of it from nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just, because I haven't worked in those mediums enough that I know that. But I mean, it is a challenge and wherever you write, but I would think it's not as difficult as playwriting.
Well, yeah. And
that, or lucrative, yes. I know that. But that's
why that makes a lot of sense, though, because you have so many writers coming in and leaving shows.
Yeah, you got people coming in and coming out. You just have to know the show, know the characters. I mean, the people that create the shows are one thing and get the show off the ground, I think, is another thing. But then once you get going, you're kind of like, well, like spec scripts. How hard is it to write a spec script for a show that's been on the air for a few years? You know what the characters are doing. You just put them in a situation. And I'm just bitter, Matt. That's all.
Aren't we all? That's a big part of theater is being bitter.
Well, if you weren't bitter, why would you even be in theater? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know, right? That's a big part of comedy. You have that bitterness to drive you.
Is it? You think the stand-ups are bitter? Do you think they're?
Well,
bitter? You're not bitter though.
I mean, I have my moments. I would say, no. I think anytime that you're in a performance aspect,
You're gonna be a little bitter about it. You try to love everybody and then you're like, well, what about me? It's that small sense of like purpose and needing for whatever it is to be out there and either writing or acting or performing. Or that you want to do it all the time, and if you're not, it can be sometimes taxing on the soul. You have to be grateful for what you have.
Definitely.
I have this.
Oh, you have a piece of ash.
It's a volcanic rock.
Oh, nice.
Anyway, sorry. Go
ahead. That is yours. That's a thing that you can call your own.
It is?
Yes. So train of thought coming back.
It's going well.
The train has left
my
brain.
What about your theater experience? This is your podcast. So, what is the thing that you enjoy? If you have to take, I ask people this too.
Yes.
Of the top three things that you do in theater, as an educator, a writer, a performer, an actor, or whatever, if you had to pick the top three, what would they be?
Oh, the top three. I mean, I've always definitely really liked performing.
Performing.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I did get into stand-up is when I was doing so many other things, at least I could still get up on stage somewhere.
Right.
However, going into things like directing, I found that I really do like to be kind of behind the scenes in some way of kind of being bigger than the actor on stage. Not in a way of like me having any kind of ego, be like, I must be bigger than the actors, but
the
just
Wizard
like
of Oz, yes, controlling it all. Yeah, I know what you're saying though. Yeah,
but yeah, having that element. I mean, even in sound design, where I really do like doing sound design, it's that idea where I can kind of set the tone of the play, kind of be a bigger part of the show. Now, I mean, there is something to be said, like when you're acting, you're on stage, you're in it, and you feel that rush and that connection, there's that energy, and there's really nothing that can you know, completely replace that. But there's just, you know, also going into the side of it of the design work of, I am creating this thing, this feeling.
Yeah, you're creating a feeling, and it's coming from you. You know, you're the one that's creating it. So I'm not a designer of that sense, but I can understand that. But so if you to pick the top three, so what's your third favorite that you would say of those three?
Acting, design, and I want to say, because I found that I do like to direct and to help people.
I like to direct.
That's pretty good. But I also really like writing and I should do more of it.
That's, you should do more of it. I think you should do a lot more of it. Why am I talking like Alan Alda? I don't understand. Yes, you should do more of it.
Yes.
So what do you like to write as you've been writing? You've been writing some plays, and I know you're working with some of the young people in there with the...
As far as like writing plays and stuff, I started out doing... So I wrote these screenplays. The first probably play that I ever write, because I had these ideas. I'm like, oh, this would be great. This would be a great idea to do. I can't write because I'm not a writer. That's what I was like in high school. And I just zero confidence in myself because I've never done it. So ultimately what it came down to was I graduated high school by making a movie, and it was going to be a spoof movie.
I
wrote, it was this script for this movie called The Frightening, which was a spoof of the movie The Haunting.
Oh.
And it was this spoof of scary movies in general. And then just luckily enough, the movie Scary Movie came out like a little bit afterwards. I was like, oh, hey, that's funny. It's kind of like what I did, and then they did it. It's funny. Not that I, thought that they're, of course, they ripped it off of me, this little high schooler. No. Anyway. So going forward from that, I suddenly got this confidence of like, oh, I can write things. And I just copied ideas from things that I liked.
Yes.
That I was into. And then just kind of used that as a reference point of, I'm going to make a movie out of this. Or I wrote, like, I was in a film class, and I wrote a slasher movie about a mime. Using the base of theater superstitions.
Yes. The theater mime superstitions. Yes. You mean like the Scottish play superstitions?
Yeah. And, like the idea is like if you say his name in the theater, then right. He comes out. Oh,
well, it sounds powerful.
Yes, there's
power there.
And then, as far as like, I think I stopped writing for a little while. And then after I decided I'm not going to be a film person, and then once I got back into theater at SDSU, I started writing back up with a group of friends, and we did sketch comedy, and we did spoofs of the... It was very much like a Sea Lions Tonight department show spoof, and it kind of got me writing again. And also around the time when I was working with you, which was a little bit before SDSU, I think I took a writing class with you, or a lesson taught by you.
Yes, a little lesson, a private lesson. Yes.
A private lesson. But I thought it was really interesting what you were talking about. Just the idea of like what you can, you just like write one thing down and then you can figure out more about the person, along. About the situation, based off of that one line that you wrote down. It's like, okay.
It is interesting how different people write. And I think that's because I teach playwriting now. And it's interesting how you do that, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like sometimes you get a topic, an idea, or you just write a line of dialogue and then you keep going.
Yeah.
And I know you're writing about, was it My Life or something? Is what you're
writing? Oh, yeah. So I was looking around things in your...
In the house.
In your house. And so I was like, So I used like... there's a guy sitting in a school cafeteria or something like that in college, and he's reading a book. Oh, well, he said, what kind of book? I was like, he's reading My Life. And then you're like, okay, well, what does that tell about him? Like, and then somebody comes up and then asks about the book, and then it's more of like that can launch.
It can launch you into where you sometimes when you write, you know where you're going, and sometimes when you write, you don't know yet. And it's subconscious writing, and you're writing subconsciously, and there's something deeper. Sometimes there's something deeper there that it's there. You just like, you just got to have faith in what you're writing until it comes out. And you go, Oh, yeah. Have you ever written something and then somebody goes, it's interesting. This was, I saw this, this, and this in there. And you're like, huh. Yeah, I guess so. I didn't even know I wrote that in there. But that person got something out of that writing some way, which you're like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it resonated.
Yeah, it resonated, and they got something out of it, which is great, I think, you know. So, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
What do I know?
Oh, yeah, no. I think that I really took that with me throughout my whole rest of my writing career or my writing adventures.
Well, if you back up a little bit, did you write a lot when you got the... How'd you like the MA program at San Diego State University?
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I thought my whole feel on it was I couldn't like necessarily sit back and let let them teach me or like... If I wanted the most out of that program, it was like I would have to take the chances, which is something that they tell you. It's not just sitting back and going to the classes and them asking you, oh, do you want this? Do you want that? It's a little bit of, you know, you going in and saying, oh, I'd like to do this. Right. I'd like to do that. A lot of my experiences, my great experiences was chasing after, I want to be an assistant director for this show with CJ Keith and so doing things like that was really, really beneficial to me. And it also, they, I think, really liked it because it showed initiative and, kind of they could see more where I was going. And I felt like, because of the things that I picked, they were able to, design it in a way that suited me.
That's good. That's great.
Yeah. And so instead of doing maybe a lot of, it seems like that's more of like a research-based program.
Yeah. I mean, I'd agree with you. I think I enjoyed it. They left things wide enough open that you can explore what you needed to explore. And then there was still that basis there. And that's almost eight, nine years ago now that I had that program, 10 years ago almost. But I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's just like you did. You had the initiative to go off and do stuff and I could do different projects and special projects outside of school. And, it was great. I really enjoyed it. It was more academic than... my second program, which I really appreciated all the academia in that program. So I think that was great.
That's also great because I think it's so important to be able to just talk about here's a play or, here's a statement that somebody said about this. What do you think about it? Yeah. Or here's a painting. How does it resonate with you? Or, how do you feel about this?
Yeah.
So I think having those discussions are really, really good.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Not only just, for the creative, but as a critical aspect, which also kind of launched me into doing things like this, like hey, let's just talk about things we like.
Yeah, talk about theater and things you like.
Yeah, so in my other podcast, The Arrow of Time, we sit and we talk about Doctor Who for 90 minutes.
Ah, Doctor Who. Yes. I want to have a podcast just like on food. Somehow.
Yes.
I very rarely listen to podcasts.
Yes.
I don't know how to access them.
Oh, well, you access them on iTunes and Stitcher and Podomatic, one of those, all those lovely things.
I want to, there's got to be a one on cheese.
Oh, absolutely.
Is there one on cheese?
I'm sure that if you like typed in like cheese podcast, you would get.
Cheese podcast.
It's kind of like, fish. I've always been told, I was told very young in like seventh grade science, like think of the weirdest kind of craziest fish that you can in your brain. And just like, don't even like worry about whether or not it exists. Just try to make one up. Just invent one. And it probably exists.
It probably does.
Just because of like how weird fish look.
Yeah.
And that's my take on podcasts. Think of any weird, random, crazy podcast out there, and there's probably that.
There. You're right. I
yes.
Wouldn't disagree with you on that.
Yeah. So, as we are, we're growing a little closer to time, right?
Yes,
now.
Yes. This time of a rehearsal tonight.
You have a rehearsal tonight.
Yes, we're all in the timing.
We're all in the all in the timing.
Yeah, I'm directing all in the timing.
Yes.
Southwestern College.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's fun. It's fun to watch.
I feel like part of me wants to be like, there should be a Matt Thompson part two.
There could be.
Yes.
We could do this again.
Yes.
We can talk more.
I'm excited about this. Yeah. Anyway, so I briefed you beforehand.
You did.
I did. Have you given much thought to the
The philosophy
your personal philosophy of theater. I mean, I feel like you have a lot of fun, wacky things, but you also have a very unique look as well on theater.
I don't know. I think theater does so many different things, and I think that's what's so hard to just nail down a philosophy about one thing, because
it doesn't have to be like the right philosophy, but just like how do you approach theater, or what is your taste in theater?
My taste in theater is, I don't know, it's weird because you really do like it all. I like, theater has to touch people in terms of emotion, but it's also something that, it's a great platform for social change as well.
Yeah.
And I think theater was one of those big things that did that many years ago, which was a big, you know, entertain people, but it also was able to make changes in the world. And a lot of that social change has moved into other mediums, but I still think that to do it on a grassroots level, making social change through a piece of theater or making people laugh is pretty incredible. Even in today's age with all the things that we have technology wise, I think it's pretty neat.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That's great. And that actually is something that resonated when I first watched Hemingway's Rose, or when we first did that, where there is this little bit at the end, the twist of the play. And through this whole kind of like almost seemingly ridiculous, like what is going on in this show play at the very end? Like, I remember you having a very passionate discussion with the director.
Yes, I remember
about
this.
The reasoning of it.
Yeah.
And it needs to be like this because, you know, if this character keeps on going through this route, that like this is what they're going to turn into.
Yeah, that's the path. So that's where the circles again.
Yes.
You know, work in circles a lot. Like you keep repeating yourself. Like I do keep repeating myself as a playwright in some of the plays, but there's a reason for it. And that's because if you keep going in this circle, you're never going to break out.
You
know, like the things like going into this MA program or going into stand-up or doing a podcast or doing all these different things that you think of things so narrowly sometimes, not in a negative way, but just because that's the path you're choosing. But if you don't break it, then you're just going to keep doing the same thing over and over, which doesn't mean it's wrong, but sometimes it's subconsciously good to make a different choice or a different direction or move somewhere else or, you know, eat a different kind of grilled cheese sandwich or whatever, you know, which I've done on occasion. I had a London Fog grilled cheese.
That sounds delightful.
It was terrible, but I tried it. I did try it. Then I went back to the other kind.
Yes.
The veggie cheese.
The veggie cheese.
It was pretty good.
From a vegetable?
From a vegetable. Vegetable cheese.
Oh, wow.
Well, can I ask you, are you going to come see this show, this one-man show I'm doing?
Oh, yes. This is another great way to cross promote.
Oh yeah.
So also in addition to listening to this fine podcast, you are about to go and record another podcast tonight, also on the on a Modern Profession Network.
Yes, on Dallas McLaughlin
on the Kept Faith.
Kept Faith. That's right. We're going to talk about baseball, a little bit of the natural on that one. But
more importantly, there's a show that you wrote.
There's a show. It's a one man show that was commissioned by North Coast Rep and the San Diego Hall of Champions called Ted Williams, A Tip of the Cap. And it's a baseball play about the famous baseballer Ted Williams, who played for the Red Sox and the Pacific Coast League Padres here in San Diego many years ago. And it's going up for one night.
Oh, wow.
On April 25th at 7 o'clock at Point Loma Playhouse. So it's a donation only, and all the proceeds go to the Jimmy Farber Cancer Fund, which is a kids cancer fund out in Boston, and that was Ted Williams's favorite charity.
Nice. You're a huge fan of Ted Williams and of baseball.
I'm a huge fan of baseball, and I like Ted Williams. He's I think he's a controversial kind of character. He's got a lot of internal conflict, which makes for a good play, I guess, because you have a lot of conflict in the play. But he was an incredible ball player, just absolutely amazing.
Nice.
So I hope everybody comes out to see it.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
April 25th.
So, 7 o'clock. Yes. You can see some of Matt Thompson's fantastic writing right there in action. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Matt, for coming on this podcast. It was great.
Matt, thank you.
Yes.
Always a pleasure to see you and talk to you.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, have a great rehearsal.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right, everybody. That is the podcast for the day. I hope you enjoyed it. It was great talking with Matt Thompson, getting a little bit more familiar with all of the things that really make Matt, Matt. This is like the second Matt in a row that we've had on this podcast. It's great. Let's keep it going. So just for reference, if you would like to listen to this podcast and others like it, please go to amodernprofession.com where you can find others. We actually caught Matt on his way to record the Kept Faith or the Kept Faith podcast, also on A Modern Profession. They talked about his play, his upcoming play, or from, I guess, this point of view, his past coming play, because this is, I'm just recording this speech a day after his play aired, called Ted Williams, The Tip of the Cap. If you were like me and missed that opportunity to see this fantastic piece of theater and baseball in one, which is really great. I mean, I feel like since Damn Yankees, there's not been a greater piece of baseball theater. Or Take Me Out. There's like Take Me Out, Damn Yankees, and Ted Williams, The Tip of the Cap by Matt Thompson, our very own. So if you would like to see more works of Matt Thompson, he has a show coming up at the Point Loma Playhouse in June. Go ahead and keep your eyes and ears out for that. We'll be promoting it here as time goes on, as it gets closer to the date. But it is called A Complete History of the Theater Abridged. So I'm actually working on that with Matt, as we talked a bit about. So go ahead and check that out. And be sure to check out all the other podcasts again on A Modern Profession. And go to iTunes, Podomatic. Please rate us, leave us a review. And if you want to check out our Twitter, what we're tweeting, it is at Stage Podcast. And once again, visit the network site at www.amodernprofession.com. With all that said, I have been Matt, and this has been Stage Voices.
Thank you for listening to A Modern Profession podcast. For more podcasts you might enjoy and information on live shows and how you can get involved, visit amodernprofession.com or check us out on Twitter at @amodernpro or on Instagram at @amodernprofession. Thank you. Good night.